into false teaching. As we've already gone through 1 and 2 Timothy, we've observed that Titus, the book of Titus, covers the same material. Very, very, and has to go through a lot of adverse criticism. And so Paul is writing to both Timothy and to Titus, giving them the encouragement that they need to stand up under this criticism. Both of them are men that have been left to normal human thing for all of us to do under those circumstances is to become despondent, to back off, to have a disposition of what is the use, they fight me on every turn, and why put forth the effort, and such things as this, and so it causes us to become more timid than what we ought to. So reading these books then, and seeing the teaching in these books, is to build up the encouragement that you need to go ahead and do what God tells you to do, regardless of the circumstances that are around you. Okay, with Titus, there's only three chapters. We're down in chapter 2 and in verse 9. Let us, just as far as review is concerned, let us not go into what has been said about these people. But note, in this chapter, Paul is talking about different classes of people. And he's telling Titus that he is to teach different groups of people to do different things. If you'll notice, in verse 2, he said, teach the older men, the aged men, to do... Then, in verse 3, teach the older women, the aged women, to do something entirely different. Then, in verse 4, the young women are to be taught... something entirely different. And then in verse 6, the younger men are to be taught... something different. And then, in verse 7, and Titus, you yourself are to do something different. Now, why? Why all these different things? And look now in verse 9. Here's another group. The next group, you teach servants or slaves to do something. Something entirely different. Now, he's not teaching them, the aged men, to do... Then in verse 3, teach the older... he's not teaching that old men can't rob banks, but young men can rob banks. You see, older men can murder and young men can't, and the young men can rob banks, but the older men can't. He's not teaching different standards of morality, but he does say, when you're talking to older men, you teach them this. And when you're talking to younger men, you zero in on this. Older women on this, younger women on this. When you talk to slaves, you talk... Why? Why does he pick out different things for different groups?
It's their particular problem.
That's right. Every group has its own particular problem, has its own particular temptations that it has to go through, and they need to be taught to do that. If you are looking at somebody that's 50 years old and he has a son that is 16 years old, and the son just got his driver's license yesterday, and you're going to give some advice on driving to both parties. Would there be different advice? You'd teach a young man, now son, keep your foot off the accelerator, wouldn't you? What'd you tell the old man? Put yours on it. See, quit driving down the road 15 miles an hour and making everybody nervous and causing wrecks. Older men, drive faster. Younger men, slow up. Why? Why would you teach that? Because you want both parties to drive the way they should be driving. See, you're trying to get both groups to do exactly the same thing. Drive the right speed properly. So that's what he's talking about here. There's one standard of morality, one standard of right and wrong. But every group of people has a different set of temptations, and so they need to be encouraged then in different ways. Okay, as we get down then to verse 9, he's going to be talking about slaves, and he's going to tell them to do something that he doesn't tell masters to do. What would be a temptation of a slave? If you were just jerked out of this classroom right now and taken to some far-off country and thrown out in a little hut, and said, now, you're a slave, and they give you a good beating just to make sure that you understand who the master is, and put a chain on you so that you won't run away, what would be a temptation that you have then that you don't have right now?
Rebel,
isn't it? One of vengeance. Hatred would start building up in your heart, rebelling, whatever I'm told to do, I'm not going to do it. If I can get that fella, I will get that fella. Would you have any temptation to steal? Would you? I'm talking about you. Now, tonight, I'm not going to talk to you much about stealing. I'm not going to really get down seriously and talk to you people and tell you, don't steal. You know why? I don't think you have that much problem. I don't believe we have anybody in here that just has a terrible problem with stealing. But if you were taken off and made a slave, would you have any problem with stealing?
Could you improve your own thing?
That's right. Would you justify it?
Really?
How would you justify stealing if you were a slave?
I deserve it.
I deserve a whole lot more than what I'm getting. And that no good, you know, man up there, he's taking what is mine, he's taking my life, and he doesn't deserve it, and I do deserve it, and so I'll get it one way or the other. And you would justify it, wouldn't you? So that's what Paul is dealing with here with Titus. He's telling him every group of people has their own unique set of problems. And so you exhort them in this. As these people have been pulled out of the pagan religions, pulled out of the world, and put into Christ, it has just turned the fabric of society upside down. Now, we've already talked about slavery back as when Paul was talking to Timothy about it, but I want to just call your attention to some of the things that we said back there. When we talk about slavery today, it doesn't mean much to us, does it? A man on the game commission this past week was fired because he used a derogatory term, to a minority group. And he said, I never use that term. He said, I never said, I don't even repeat a joke. And this newsman said, I heard you do it. And the government said, if he heard you do it, you're fired. And you've been fired. And that's the way it is. So today, we don't even get close to slavery. We don't even get close to saying something ugly about somebody. You see, we don't even get close in there. What I'm saying is, do you suppose that our problems are a little bit different than their problems? Do you suppose they have some problems that we don't have? Those people that were slaves? Now, stop to think. In our society, where we've outlawed slavery, we've outlawed discrimination of every kind, we've bent over backwards to where now you can't even discriminate in the realm of morals. Our society is going this way. Back in those days, it is estimated from upwards of one-third of the society were slaves. One out of every three human beings was slave. And in those days, slavery did not just consist of the lower class of individual. That's what you think of when you think of a slave, isn't it? It's somebody who's uneducated, who has been deprived of the good things of life, deprived of education, keep them so they can't read, and use them out there as an animal. But in those days, they had slaves of every different level in society. Many of their doctors were slaves. See, that's what they would do. They would take a medical doctor and make a slave out of him. Any idea how you can make a slave out of a medical doctor? You go try that today. I mean, make him your personal slave. And you tell him, get in that corner and sleep over there. When I get sick, you come and you deal with me. And don't you move until I tell you to. Try that with a physician today. Now, why could they do it back then? Any idea? Why it would work?
People that have to sell themselves into slavery, I imagine.
Okay, there's a good reason. A man get in financial difficulty, and so he sells himself into slavery. His family might go out and get him into financial difficulties, and so he has no alternative other than to do that. Now today what we would do is that we would file a lawsuit against the individual and have it in court for 20 years and not become a slave. But did you do that back at those days? See, no, you might file a lawsuit, but you're a slave while you're doing it. And you go up there, slavery was not frowned upon, it was not looked upon as an evil thing, and if you did not have an absolute ironclad case, there was no appealing, yet bang, you're it. So there were slaves of every form and description. So what I'm trying to do is paint the picture so we can understand that was a unique problem. Now here's another thing we think about in this generation, at least I do. And that is that those were the bad old days, right? Those were the old days back when people lived that were not as intelligent as what we are. And so those days were over, and from here on for the next 100,000 years or whatever it is the Lord comes back again, there'll never be those days again. Is that right? No, that's not right. You have to understand, we're living in a very small segment of society. How long has it been since slavery has been done away in America?
About 110 years.
All right. Just a little over 100 years since that the law was made. Now, after the law was made, did it end on that day?
No.
And we go ahead and we then didn't legally own slaves, but did we have slaves for the next 100 years? We said you can't drink out of our water fountains, you can't ride on our buses, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can clean my sewer lines, and you can sweep the street, and you can do this, and so we had practical slaves, is really what we had. When did that come to an end? Do you remember?
25 years ago.
Okay, 1954. I mean, we're getting up close now, right? We're getting up close. I'm probably the only guy who wasn't born at that time. In here. See, the rest of you, old people at that time. We're talking about our lifetime when that happened. Okay, did discrimination end when the Supreme Court in 1954 said it's over? No, it didn't end. We're still living in it, right? See, we're still living in this confused situation. You have to stop to think. We're living in a pinpoint of time. Slavery has been up to this time, and will slavery be after this time? Don't kid yourself. We're living in a short period of time in an economic situation and in a situation of where you can't believe the blessings that we have in our economy that we're living in that other people have not had and will not have again in the future. And everybody born at that time in here. See, the rest of you, the old people at that time, we're talking about our lifetime. And going right back into this. Slavery is a human problem. It's always been with us. It will always be with us. You and I are unique. We happen to live in a few years of where it is not a great big problem right here. So look at it and look at it seriously because it is a problem of mankind. Okay. Now he says, exhort servants to be in subjection to their own masters. Why does he tell servants and wives? You ever notice that that's what he does? When he's talking to a wife, what does he zero in on wives? Be in subjection to your husband. When he talks to servants, be in subjection to your master. Why? Because those of them, the president down, is shaking and quivering and seeing that we are destroying ourselves and pulling the rug. Right? Shackles of subjection. A servant will try to throw off the shackles of subjection in order to better themselves. And Paul said, you be in subjection to your own masters. He said, and to be well pleasing to them in all things. You try to please your masters. Now, what would you think? What do people think who really do not have a knowledge of what God teaches about slavery? What do they think Christianity really teaches about slavery? Now, the reason I ask that is this. Christianity has abolished slavery, hasn't it? If you go to the lands where Christ had been taught, you just take a... If you could take a map, take a globe, and then you paint that globe red. The places, the continents... The countries where Christ has saturated, the teachings of Christ has saturated that, you paint it. Now, if it's saturated just a little bit, then paint it light, you know, kind of your pink. If it's moderately, you know, half Muslim and half Christianity, then paint it a light red. If it has been saturated with Christianity so that Christianity is almost the national religion, then paint it dark red. Now, you paint the whole map like that. Then you go back and you get you another map. and you paint that map of the colors that deal with slavery. The countries that have hard slavery, just leave them blank. The countries that have a little bit of slavery, it's okay. The countries that have no slavery, you paint them deep red. The countries that has a little bit, then lighten it up. The countries that has half and half, put it pink. Do you know what you will have when you get through painting the two maps and you look at them? You'll have identical maps. And do you know what that shows you? Everywhere the gospel of Christ goes, what happens to slavery? Slavery is dissipated. Slavery is taken out of the way. Now, is Christ opposed to slavery? Well, there it is, obviously. He abolishes it. He takes it out of the way. He removes it. So, what would any intelligent man expect to find when you open up the book and began to read in the gospel? What would you expect him to say about slavery?
Thou shalt not have slavery.
Yeah, thou shalt not have slavery. Rise up, slaves. Throw off the shackles. March and get rid of slavery. That's what we would expect, but not so. He does exactly the opposite way. Instead of upsetting society, putting society in an absolute turmoil, the doctrine of Christ does not do that. It comes in and it begins to work on the inside of people. And it begins to work on the inside of society. The Word, the Gospel, affects people. The Gospel will change me. Then I will change the society, my little group that I'm in. And then the Gospel will change somebody else. That person will influence this little circle of society they're in. And a little while, as the Gospel is preached more and more, and people turn more and more to Christ, and the entire country then will begin to be influenced by the teachings of Jesus Christ. And all of a sudden, as they're influenced by the teaching of Christ, then here's what you find. Christ tells that servant, you be the best servant you can possibly be. Now, to Titus, he's not going to be talking to masters. But in Timothy, he did, and Ephesians and Colossians, he did. What does he tell a master to do? You be the best master you can possibly be. You be as kind and gentle and considerate as you can be. In fact, go ahead and be a master. Own all the slaves that you want to own. Just remember, do unto them as you would want them to do unto you. You love them as you love yourself. When Paul wrote to Philemon, who was a slaveholder, what did he tell him about his slave, Onesimus? What did he tell him to do there? Did he say, you release him? Keep him as a slave. It's up to you. See, keep him as a slave. He said, the only thing that I request is, you treat him exactly like you would treat me if I came to live with you. Now, how would you like to be a slave in somebody's house like that? Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to be a slave? If you were a slave the way Jesus Christ teaches. And so, just stop to think. If you had a master that was like Christ, and taught you and treated you in that way, and then you worked for that master and you made him rich and you prospered him and trustworthy and never gave him any problems and he honored you and helped you, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? But in all this wonderful society, what happens to slavery then? The slavery as we know it. All the harshness and all the stain is taken out of it. And if you have slavery with all of the stain taken out of it, the only thing you have is just the shell or the name, isn't it? That's all that's left. It's just a name. And the situation is good. That's the way Jesus Christ went about revolutionizing the world and changed as Christ teaches. And so, just stop to think. If you had a master that was like Christ and taught you, and you be well-pleasing to them in all things, not gainsaying. Deb, you're the number one gainsayer. What is that? What does gainsaying mean?
I'm sure it's nothing I'd be guilty of.
Oh, no. What is gainsaying? You might know what the word is. It comes from two words. It comes from gain. Say. Now, do you know what that means?
Buttering up.
No. No, not buttering up.
King James says, answering again. for that phrase.
Okay, what it means is speaking against. Speaking against is what it means. Do you know what anti means, anti, in Greek? If you're anti anything, it means opposed to. That's what it means. Now the word there, instead of getting saying, is anti-speaking. So don't you be anti-speaking. Don't you be speaking against. So here, the slave, the owner comes out, and the owner says, today, Tim, I want you to go out, and I want you to do this, and I want you to do this. Now, Tim, it's your time. Now, what do you say?
I'm not so sure I want to do that.
Yeah, so then you speak against what I'm saying, see? And so it has the idea of opposition, rebellion, cantankerous, troublemaker, see, is the idea. Instead of him letting me be the master, and him being the servant, and him going and doing this, no, he's going to be a troublemaker. So, don't you do that. See, don't you do that. You recognize your role, and you recognize the role of your master. So, don't you be gainsaying. And then, not purloining. Oliver, you must be a good purloiner. What is a purloin? When's the last time you purloined, anyway?
I wish I knew.
What about that? Tim, you been doing any of that lately?
Of course not.
Of course not. Surely you wouldn't purloin, would you? What is purloin?
Pilfering.
Right. What's pilfering?
Stealing.
Right. What kind of stealing? It's not bank robbery. Oh. Purloining is not bank robbery. What?
Say from your employer. Home.
That's right. It's taking home things. It's just removing. That's mine anyway. You know, he didn't give me a raise last month, and so I'll take this. And so it's just taking things, just removing things from the premises of your master, of somebody else. That's purloining. Stealing. It's what we would call more petty stealing rather than hardcore bank robbery, you see. So that's the idea of purloining. Now, would a slave have a tendency? Would you as a slave have a tendency to purloin? Yeah. You certainly would. Would you have a tendency to bank rob? No. A slave, he'd probably be the last one. Who robs banks? The affluent that has the automobile. That's right. It's taking home things. It's just removing. That's mine anyway. Temptation, and he would have a pretty good excuse for doing it too, wouldn't he? You see, in trying to justify it, it would sound awfully good to him to justify it in that way. Okay, so don't you do that. But here's how you're to act. But showing all good fidelity. Now I know what fidelity is. There's fidelity mutual. And there's fidelity banks. And about everything I know that has any fidelity to it has to do with money and banks and so forth. Lots of fidelity bonds, you see. What does the word fidelity mean when you see fidelity bank? First fidelity. Or something.
Honesty.
Okay, that's right. Trustworthy. Faithfulness. You know what the word is, by the way, for fidelity? Can you handle this? It is the same word as faith. That's what it is. In all faith. Now, what does faith mean? Faith always has two meanings that come together. You can emphasize both of them the same or emphasize one over the other. What's the two meanings? Faith always means acceptance of testimony and then what?
Trust
again. That's right. And so, fidelity mutual means you can put your money in here and trust it. That's what it means. You can, because we are absolutely trustworthy.
Honesty.
Okay, that's right. Trustworthy. Faithfulness. So, you people then, he says, who are slaves, make sure that you are totally trustworthy. Good trustworthy. You see, in a good way. What would a slave owner do if he found a slave that was just absolutely trustworthy?
Trust him with more.
He's going to trust him with more, isn't he? And do you suppose that a master that has a slave that's just totally trustworthy, And every time he puts him to test, it just amazes him how trustworthy he is. Do you suppose he'd want to know why? Do you suppose he would think that there's anything strange about that slave? He would, wouldn't he? And as he gets to checking, he finds out that that slave is serving a certain God over here. He may never heard of that God. But what does he know about that God that this slave is serving?
It affects his life.
It affects his life in a good or bad way?
Good way.
Would I like to be like that slave? You bet. In other words, do you see the influence that there would be in doing such a thing as this? So, totally trustworthy. See, just absolutely, totally trustworthy.
Excuse me, Paul.
Yeah.
In that time, did they actually have other religions that actually promoted, the sense of dishonesty, just to pick a certain characteristic? You know, like today, we don't have that. We think if someone's going to be dishonest, they are further away from God in the way we generally say. But the point is, in those times, did they actually...
It's a checking. He finds out that that slave is serving a certain God over here. He may never heard of that. Yes, I could say yes to that. They had religions that would promote a rebellious attitude in people. Well, like we do today. We have certain ones that that do that. In some of the cults that come along, they promote rebellion. But as far as having a religion that promoted... they had religions that promoted immorality in the sexual realm. But to have religions that promoted immorality... In the financial realm or in the stealing and things of this nature, no, I don't think that they had any. They had religions that didn't condemn it, but it didn't. They didn't promote it. In the
they have religions that promoted rebellious sense in people.
It's the honorable thing to do is to become as rich as you can become and do this and do that and pleasure and all of this. So in that sense, they did. But I don't know of any that actively said, it's okay to steal. Okay. But they all did it, just like today. You see, they all did it. Okay. The next then, it says, you do all of this that they may adorn the doctrine of God, our Savior, in all things. Now, here you're trying to adorn the doctrine. When you adorn yourself, ladies especially would know what adorning means. That's when you dress yourself up in such a way that you look nice, that you're very attractive. All right, now, we are to adorn the doctrine. We're to make the doctrine that is taught, the doctrine of Jesus Christ, look nice. The doctrine will be pretty. It will be attractive to people. And how do you adorn the doctrine? By the way you live. See, that's what he's saying. By being totally trustworthy in every way, people then will appreciate the gospel of Jesus Christ and see it as a beautiful teaching. So that's how you adorn it. Now then, he goes ahead and he says in verse 11, for the grace of God hath appeared, bringing salvation to all men, instructing us to the intent that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly and righteously and godly in this present world, looking for and so forth and so on. Now, here's the reason why that a slave in this terribly adverse conditions, even in those adverse conditions, here's why you should be a spatial person, a godly person. It is because the grace of God hath appeared, bringing salvation to all men. Now, that's not just the reason. But this grace of God that's come bringing salvation to all men teaches us that we're to live how? Soberly and righteously. We'll get down to it in a minute, but let's see what the grace of God really means. Here it is that we have all men down here. So we'll draw some various people that's down here. And it says now that the grace of God hath appeared. It's come. Now, the word appeared means it has made its appearance. And it's used for the sun that comes up in the morning. That when you get up before the sun comes up and you go out in the morning and you look out there and you see the red sky and you see things and it's still dark, it's half dark, it's half light. What is it that you notice in just a minute if you stay out there looking over to the east? What do you always see? What catches your eye? What do you never miss? the sun. All of a sudden, there it is. See? Now, what does the sun do? We say the sun comes up, don't we? See, the sun is coming up. The word that they used is the sun appears. The sun, you know, it's around or somewhere, and then all of a sudden, pew, there he is, and you can see it. All right, now the grace of God has to whom? To everybody. The grace of God has come, and it's shined here, and it is bringing salvation unto all men. That really is what it's bringing. So, as we begin to talk about the grace of God, we might do it in this way. We look, I'm going to erase God now, and I'm going to put Him up here. Now, here is God, and God's grace has appeared unto all men. What do we mean about God's grace has appeared to all men? What is grace?
Unmerited favor.
It's unmerited favor. That God is doing you a favor that you don't deserve. Now, what is the favor that God does that we don't deserve? Many of them, but when you talk about the one big thing, the grace of God, what is it?
Salvation.
All right? The grace of God, God's unmerited favor has appeared and it has brought salvation unto all men. That's the idea that is here. All right, now, this passage sometimes is misinterpreted. There is a religion called universalism. And that means that God is going to save everybody. Everybody is going to be saved. Doesn't make any difference how good or how bad you are. God's going to save everybody. Because God is a God of love. He loves everybody. And He loves us too much to condemn us. And another thing is, this verse right here says He is. This verse right here says that His grace has appeared, bringing salvation to whom?
All men.
All men. So there He is. It says all men are going to be saved. Now let me ask you a question in this word. Does that passage say that God's grace has appeared, bringing salvation to all men?
Yes.
It certainly does. Does that passage say that God is going to save all men?
No,
it doesn't. And you say, but it means the same thing. No, it doesn't. It might sound like it's saying the same thing, but it doesn't. Now, here is the truth of the matter. When Jesus Christ came to save the world, who did He come to save? In fact, God so loved what? The world. That He sent His only begotten. And another thing is, this verse right here says He is. This verse right here says that His grace, anybody, everybody, the whole world, regardless of what you have done, that His salvation has appeared to every man that's ever lived. And there He is. And He's begging. In Matthew chapter 11, 28, when Jesus said, "Come unto me," who did He say? "Come unto me, you highly educated, fine, well-dressed." No. "Come unto me, all ye," everybody. God's grace has appeared, offering this salvation to everybody. Now, not everybody is going to accept it. If I give you a gift, there's two things that's necessary. The same thing with God. God's giving us a gift that we don't deserve. What has to happen for the Son? And who's invited to be saved? It's just that simple. That's the way that it is. I told you some time ago that Deb had given me a gift, right? Going up to Snoqualmie Falls. An awesome gift. Now, you know why you haven't heard about that? Of what fun I had when I went up there?
Why?
She's wondering, hadn't she, right there? I haven't accepted that gift yet. I have that piece of paper, and it's in my glove compartment. Every young lady I ask to go out won't go with me, so I can't find anybody to go with. And Ellen back there saying, take me. Deb, we haven't gone yet. Like, always been something come up to where we haven't had an opportunity to go. But here's the whole situation. Now, Deb has given me a lavish gift. What good is it doing me? Absolutely none. It's been given to me. I have the certificate out there in my car. What good is it? Suppose going home tonight, I get in an automobile accident and my automobile burns up. What's going to happen? That certificate is gone. It doesn't do me any good. I get no more good out of it than you have. And you didn't even get one. See? And here I've got it. But who got the most good out of it? Neither one of us. Because I haven't used it properly. I haven't accepted the gift. The gift really was not the paper. Is that what you just gave me with the paper?
No.
You want me to thank you for the paper?
No.
There's always been something come up to where we haven't had an opportunity to go. But here's the whole situation. Yeah, right, you see. So if I look at the paper, it's worth maybe a tenth of a penny that you gave me. If I look at the gift, see, then it's worth more than I'm making a month in there. So it's a big gift. In there. But I have to accept it. I have to appropriate it. Now, to whom did God give the gift certificate? Who did He say, here, take salvation? See? Everybody. It's free. Take it. But we have to accept it. Now, Titus is not going into detail and talking about it here and explaining it this way because he knows that everybody understands it this way. Paul doesn't. By the way, who's he writing to?
Maybe you should.
One can. What Paul's talking about? Certainly he does, see? And so, what Paul says is then, that here, the gospel has appeared, bringing salvation to all men. Now then, we're going to pick out this one individual right here, who is a slave, and the rest of these guys out here are heathens. And so now you teach this fella right here that he's to live a certain way. Because God's grace bringing this salvation to all people is instructing all of us here to live a certain way. Now we put down 1, 2, 3 and so forth. How does his salvation teach this individual or any of us to live? See, how are we supposed to live? All right, look now.
Titus.
How long has Titus been preaching the gospel? Many, many years. See? Now, in the grace, in salvation, here, we also get the instructions, don't we? Now, I might ask you this. When God gave us His Word from heaven, is that a favor that we didn't deserve? For me to get Newsweek magazine, what must I do? I don't ever get Newsweek. You know why? I don't pay for it, see. And Newsweek says no grace. if we don't send it out to everybody. So I don't pay for it, so I don't get it. Now, if they just started sending me the magazine all the time, then there would be grace involved in that. I wouldn't deserve it, but they'd be sending it to me. Did any of you subscribe to the Bible? Did any of you ever subscribe to the will of God? No. No, God devised the plan in His mind before the world ever began, and He did us a favor that we don't deserve, and He gave us that will, He gave us that wisdom to tell us how to live. Is the gospel part of the grace? Certainly it is. Alright, now in this we're taught. See, we're taught here by this great salvation that we've got to live a certain way. Here's what we're to do. He said, instructing us to the intent that denying ungodliness. That's something we must do. There are certain things we as God's people must do is deny ungodliness. Ungodliness is the wrong attitude toward God. An improper, impious, unholy attitude toward God. To the Bible, did any of you ever subscribe to the will of God? No. No, God divine of God. See, just standing in awe of God. So we're to deny that attitude. So I'm not to have a wrong attitude toward God, and I am to deny worldly lust. How many lusts are there of this world that I must deny? How many things in this world would I like to have that I must deny? A lot of them, right? See? A whole lot of them. Must I deny myself of a new car?
Maybe.
That's right, maybe. Yeah, okay. That's right. You say, yes, some of them. I might afford a new car if you can get it down at JCPenney's. I have $5 in my pocket. I can go down there and honorably get me a little toy car like this. But then when I go down to the new car shop, and here's a $25,000 car, I could get one. By the way, I could get a new car tonight. You know that? Just go on any one of these lots and hotwire it and take off and I've got it. Now, I might have the desire and the lust, but I must deny myself. Now, denying yourself means that it keeps you from from feeding any physical desire that you do not have a right to have. See? That you do not have a right to have. Whether it's in the sexual realm or whether it's in the physical realm of comforts or whatever it is, you must deny it.
Mm-hmm. Does that include denying yourself? Suppose you could afford a $25,000 car.
Again, I'd answer you like you answered me, maybe.
Yeah.
There would be circumstances, if you could afford it, that you still need to deny it yourself because it might ruin your influence in a certain community that you're in. It might be that you could afford it, but you can't afford that and
something else you should be doing
out here. And so you can't answer it, you see, in there. But no, I'm not saying that everybody's driving a $25,000 car is not doing this right here, you see. If I were making $1 million a year, I could be driving a $25,000 car and still doing a whole lot more good than Tim's doing.
Hey!
The rest of it.
So, suppose you could afford a $25,000 car.
Again, we both have to do exactly the same thing. Now, if I were making that $1 million, would that $25,000 car satisfy me? Right now, it solved every problem I've got. But if I had $1 million, then what kind of a car would I feel that I needed? See, my fleshly desires and comforts then would go on up, you see, as we do this. So it doesn't make any difference whether you're poor or rich, whether you're a master or a slave. That's the point, that God teaches that we must submit our will to His will and not live the way we would like to live. Okay. And he said, now we must deny ourselves in that, and that we should live soberly and righteously and godly in this present world. What is soberly?
Clear thinking,
sensibly. That you live in a very sensible way. See, there, Deb, is your answer. Can I own a $25,000 car? If it's sensible, it can. If it's not sensible, it can't. Sometimes it's sensible, sometimes it's not sensible to do that. So to live soberly and righteously. Righteously means the kind of actions that you have. Doing that which is right. So you always do that which is right. That is, except if somebody does wrong to you. Isn't that right? Isn't that the only exception? No, that's not even an exception. Paul deals with that in a Roman letter. If somebody does me evil, what do I do back to them? If I really want to hurt them, what do I do?
Well, I have a $25,000 car.
Say soberly. Clear thinking, sensibly. That you live in a very sensible way.
Yeah.
Oh, let's face up to it. Sure. Okay, if I really want to hurt them, what do I do? What?
Do something bad back.
No, that's not really how you hurt him. Now, that's what you do before you learn the truth. But I mean the truth, if I really want to hurt him. What I do? If I want to heap coals of fire upon their head, I really want to get do them good, you see, in there. And so what I'm saying is the teaching of Christ really works. It is effective, you see, in people. Now, obviously, we need to clear that up, that if I'm really taking vengeance and really want to do somebody harm, I really hate John and I want to hurt him, and so I go out of my way to do him good, John's probably going to see through that, right? And he's going to know that, and I'm not going to be hurt. Yeah. What do you do? Suppose somebody does something bad to me, and I really want to hurt him. By the way, would I really want to hurt him? You see, in that way. But if you really do get control of yourself and you do another person good, you can be assured that it will have an effect on that other person. The pain will be inflicted. Okay. The next is, and godly in this present world. Living. That word means reverently, is really the idea of that word. I want to check right here. Yes, piously, reverently, with that attitude, the attitude of the way God would have you to live. All right, now, we're to live in that world like that, looking for the blessed hope and appearing of... Whoa. We've already had something to appear. What has already appeared?
God's grace.
God's grace bringing salvation. Now then, here we are, we've accepted the grace, and now then we're saved, and now then we start looking for another appearing. What is it?
A blessed hope.
All right, the appearing of our blessed hope. Now, here we have a hope down here. This individual, because he's a Christian, has a hope. Hope is made up of what two things?
Desire and expectation.
All right, desire plus expectation. You have to desire something, plus you have to expect it. Now, all of these people might desire to go to heaven, but which one of them expects to go to heaven? Only the one who has accepted the salvation brought by the grace of God. So now then, we're looking out here, and we have this hope. And there is but one hope, and you call it whatever you want to, eternal life, living with God in heaven forever, going to heaven, whatever you want. That is what our hope actually is. So we're looking for that. We're looking for the time of when we can live with our God here forever. So it says, looking for the blessed hope and appearing of the glory of the great God and our Savior Jesus Christ. All right, now, in order to get this, for all of this really to happen, what is going to happen? What's the next thing that we look forward to? What's the big event that's going to happen? The coming of Christ. So we're to look now for the coming of Christ. Now, when He comes, is it going to be kind of a secret situation? Is it going to be like it was the first time? Nobody knows He's here. He's in a manger and it's insignificant. And He grows up in a poor family and rejected. Is that what it's going to be like? No, the next time it's a glorious coming. The next time He's coming with all the glory of God, with all of the angels, with the great sound of the trumpet, just a glorious situation, that is the next thing, you see, that we are to really be looking for. Something that is going to happen to us. Something we are going to see. We need to believe that. We look for a lot of things that in our life. Summer's coming on and be taking vacations. How many of you look forward to a vacation? If you're going to have a big vacation, isn't that something to really look forward to? And boy, I'm going to go. I've got the money this year, and I've got my health, and I expect. See, I really want to go, and I expect that I'll be able to go, and so I have hope of going. And so we look forward to these things happening. Now, there's going to be an event that's going to happen that is the greatest thing that we could possibly imagine. See, you could travel around the world 10,000 times. You could go to Disneyland 100 million times. You could visit Congress every day of your life. You could do all that this world offers, and you would never, ever see anything like you're going to see when the moment that Jesus Christ makes His appearance with all that glory that's going to be there. So we're to look forward to that. That's what we have to look forward to. You know, as I look forward to heaven and get to thinking about that, I look at it in different stages. I look at it here, okay, we have this desire. Now, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and there are various things. And down here is living eternally with God in here. Living eternally with God. But as I think about it, just the moment of being able to see Jesus in all of His glory, isn't that something, if that's all that there was to it? Just stop and think. If that's all that there was to it, that you'd get to see that, and then you were just wiped out of existence, what would that be worth? That worth more than all of the trips that you could ever take. See? Worth more than your whole life, if that's all that you could see. Now, and every one of us is going to see that. Now, there's another thing that I look forward to. And that is that when I die and go to paradise, just being able to see those angels for the first time, that just thrills me to death. To think about being able to see those angels. It's just something that is an absolute thrill. I think about Doris, I don't know how many times. The doctor saying, you know, she raised her head and said, I'm feeling faint, and then just died like that. And just thinking that when she died like that, and we all went into that shock and grief and all that tragedy, to think of the joy that she had, angels in that operating room. And she got to see them, and got to go with them. What would that be worth to you? That I look forward to. And that is that when I die and go to paradise, just being able to pass the moon and the universe and the billions and billions and trillions of stars. I wonder if I need to ask the angels how many stars there are out there as we're going. Will we talk as we're going out there like we do? And get to say, how many stars are there in this universe anyway? We've been arguing about that for a long time down there. And just, now is there any reason why I won't do that? Let me ask you. See? I don't know any reason. Going to heaven is a thrilling thing. That's the point that I'm trying to get at. And then entering into that paradise world and seeing that awesome sight and all that, and all of that before we finally get down to being able to. If you thought that if you were going to get to take a trip with angels tomorrow, go. Now it's been a bore. Life just a bore. Really, when you look at it, it's the thrill of what we're working for is really coming. So that's what he's saying. Now, here's another thing. He said right here, we look forward to the glory of the great God and our Savior, Jesus Christ. That verse right there is an important verse. An argument has been going on for hundreds of years, and we're not going to settle it tonight. But is he talking about two persons or one person? Is he talking about God the Father, or is he talking about God the Father and Jesus Christ, two persons? Or is he talking about Jesus Christ, and is he calling Jesus great God and our Savior, Jesus Christ? See, it depends on how you read it. And you say, oh, we can settle that. Go with the Greek, right? Greek solves everything. Doesn't help at all. Greek says the same thing as the English says. Grammar could do either one. It could tell you really either one. Is it saying here, and the appearing of the glory of the great God and our Savior, Jesus Christ? Now, when I read it that way, it sounds like two people, right? Now, then, suppose I read it this way. And either one is perfectly permissible. It said, and the appearing of the glory of the great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. That's one person, isn't it? And you say, well, which is it talking about? Well, grammatically speaking, you really can't tell. Now, I will say this. Grammatically speaking, taking grammar at its hardcore way of interpreting it, which you have to do, unless there's something in the context you see that sets it aside, and there's so many hundreds of rules of grammar, but it would be talking about one person. That's the way that it would be talking about the Jesus Christ, our great God and Savior. Like I talk about President Reagan, our president and statesman. Am I talking about two or one? Now, if I said today I saw Ronald Reagan, our president, and the congressman. Now I talk about one or two people.
I mean, I'm sure you think two.
Two. But it's because you say a congressman is not a president. And so, yeah. Now, a minute ago, I said I saw Ronald Reagan, our president, and statesman. You say, well, yeah, that goes together. You see. So then you go back and you start studying the Bible. Well, if there's somewhere in the Bible that teaches us something that's clear-cut, like a congressman is not a president, then it will be clear-cut. But as you go back, is Jesus divine? Is he deity? Is he God? Yes. And so the argument goes on, is what I'm getting at. The argument goes on and on. Now, what I understand the passage to refer to is one individual, that is Jesus Christ. Talking about this, and for this reason, that it's talking about the appearing of somebody. I am to be looking forward to the appearing of one or two. God and Jesus, or Jesus. Now, as you go elsewhere and you study, who is it that is coming back? The second coming, who, in all other passages, who do you look for?
Christ.
You look for Christ. And so, I feel that is the overwhelming influence right there that would influence me to say that is what it is, you see. Mm-hmm.
If you read on to verse 14, it clearly states that it's singular.
In verse 14 it clearly does, but here now you could read it like this. See, this is a problem. Let me read it here. See, it says, and the appearing of the glory of the great God, and the appearing of somebody. I am to be looking forward to the appearing. Yeah, right. See, so again, everything in there is talking about Jesus Christ. And so if it is talking about God the Father in addition to Jesus Christ, there's nothing else in the context that's talking about God the Father. See, so you're right. So for that reason, I think that it's talking about Jesus. And so in this, it's like in John chapter 1, verse 1, where it definitely identifies him and attributes deity to him. Okay. In verse 14, it says that we're to look for the coming of Jesus Christ. It said, who gave himself for us, that he might redeem us from all iniquity and purify unto himself a people for his own possession, zealous of good works. So here Paul, writing to Timothy, again, doesn't go into detail, but it does show the greatness of Jesus Christ, the one who's coming back. He came first, and he did redeem us. Now, when salvation appeared to all men, what did it take to redeem us? By the way, what does redeem mean?
Buy back.
All right, so he came and he bought us back with his blood. See, is what it says. The first time he came and bought us with his blood, and the reason he bought us with his blood is to redeem us from all iniquity. Iniquity means sin. Every person was caught up in sin. Jesus Christ shed his blood, purchased us, and did away with sin. Now, why did he do this? He did it to purify us, so he'd make us pure, get rid of all of that sin. So here Paul, writing to Timothy, again, doesn't go into detail, but it does show the greatness of Jesus. Right, what's the purpose of that? Now, what did he do? He purified unto himself a people. Now then, the people right here, that Jesus Christ came and brought salvation to all of them, but the people who are washed in the blood of Christ have been purified. Then they are people that have been purified unto himself for his own possession. He now owns us. He is the owner. Of course, when he talks about the church, whose church does he say it is? Upon this rock I will build my church. See? And the church is composed of people. All right, so it's people that he owns, and here now is the key. What is the character and quality of these people that Jesus purchased and owns? How do you identify them? How do you describe them? What kind of people are they? They are people that are zealous of good works. They don't just do good works, but they're zealous of good works. What's the difference? What is zeal?
Initiative.
It's being excited about something. It's being totally dedicated to something. It is devoting yourself to something. And that's the kind of people that you have here. People who are purified, they belong to Christ, and the way you characterize them is they don't just go around with a big long face and say, well, Christian, so I have to be good. See? That's not the way they are. They are zealous. They enjoy it. They dedicate their life to being good. So servants, slaves, the next time you get ready to purloin, stop to think you belong to Jesus Christ. He bought you, and one of your characters is that you get up every morning zealous to do good. Obey your master, deny all ungodliness, do all of these good things, be zealous of good works. Now he said, Titus, here's what I want you to do in verse 15. These things speak and exhort and reprove with all authority. You get busy and you speak them, you tell the people this, you exhort them, that is, you plead with them, you build them up, and then you reprove them, that is, you bawl them out. You teach them every way you can. You tell them, build them, knock them down, whatever is necessary, you teach in whatever way to cause people to be this kind of people. And let no man despise you. The word despise means look around you. Do you get the point? Let no man despise you. That word itself doesn't just mean detest you. But is it possible for a preacher to come in here Sunday and he preaches about what kind of people we ought to be, and he kind of hits me and I'm kind of guilty, and so I just kind of look around, I overlook him, is what we say. Well, I'll overlook him, you know. I mean, the kid got a little carried away. He's a young whippersnapper anyway, you know, doesn't know too much. And isn't it easy, especially for older people, to just look around and not let the doctrine penetrate our hearts? So he said, Titus, you preach in such a way, people can't ignore you. And make sure they can't ignore you. Can't just look around like this. Okay, any comment or question? Okay, if not, last dismissal. But is it possible for a preacher to come in here Sunday and he preaches about what kind of people we ought to be, and he kind of hits me and I'm kind of guilty, and so I just kind of look around, I overlook him, is what we say. Well, I'll overlook him. You know, I mean, the kid got a little carried away. He's a young whippersnapper anyway. You know, doesn't know too much. And isn't it easy, especially for older people, to just look around and not let the doctrine penetrate our hearts? So he said, Titus, you preach in such a way people can't ignore you. And make sure they can't ignore you. Can't just look around like this. Okay, any comment or question? Okay, if not, class dismissed.